Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we've put on our bulletproof vest to talk about Ben Wheatley's new film, Free Fire. And as well as firing our usual film discussion, we've got lots more in the chamber for this special show. And joining me to help pick up the debris from Free Fire and put it back together is Lawrence Jackson, MA Film Practice Lecturer at the University of Kent. Our very own Sam Howlett also spoke to Ben Wheatley, the director of the film, about the new picture, and we'll be broadcasting that conversation shortly. And finally, Free Fire is not actually the only film out this week. Christian Munzu, who you may know as the director of the Palme d'Or winning 4 months, 3 weeks and 2 days, returns with a new film called Graduation, and we were lucky enough to sit down to speak to him about that film too. So it is a ginormous episode of the Curzon Film Podcast this week. But before we do our regular podcast pitch to begin the show, some introductions are in order. Lawrence, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Lawrence, Ben Wheatley has become a heavily dropped name in your filmmaking classes. When did you first come across him, and what did you see in his work that made you want to share it with all your students?
Well, the first time was in 2011 when Kill List came out, and that was when he started to get more attention. And I watched Down Terrace, which was 2009, and marketed. If you see the cover of the DVD, it looks like a kind of post-Lockstock Brit gangster film, which it really isn't. You know, it's something different from that. So since then, I've followed his films, Sightseers, A Field in England, High Rise, and now Free Fire. And he's made 6 films in 8 years, which is pretty impressive by anyone's standards in the States, let alone Britain, Europe. Okay, so I think he's just going from strength to strength.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal achievement. We were talking about Xavier Dolan recently, and I think he's going for the same 6 in 8 years. But I think there's a bit, when you look at the scope of Wheatley's films and the breadth of it, there's a phenomenal amount of craft that he puts himself into that's just so different as well.
Absolutely. He, I think, hearing him interviewed, he doesn't intellectualize. He resists. He's not pretentious. He's incredibly straightforward. That's the way he comes across. And so I'm going to be the intellectual. I'm going to intellectualize about him. I don't think he has yet the critical consideration he merits. And there is even a backlash against him among some, certainly academics, and it's to do with him. It's a kind of snobbery. He makes popular cinema. But that's not the whole story. And so all of his films, for example, A Field in England, he referenced Onibaba, the Japanese ghost story movie, and Culloden, the Peter Watkins film from the 60s. You know, he really knows he's a cineast, but he wears it lightly. So that's endearing.
Yeah. Yep. And I think he uses genre to his advantage a lot of the time to then play off of that fact as well. I'm thinking of, like, particularly in Kill List, there's a lot there that I think it might have been an interview with him where he was saying about just not cutting away where he's so used to everyone else cutting away.
Yeah, he's, as you see in many directors' CVs, they often come through being editors, sometimes screenwriters, sometimes actors. And Wheatley, I see, with Amy Jump, his partner, he's an editor par excellence, and so montage and screen space, silence, stretching the moment, he's been doing that from the start. But I think the quantum leap, I believe, was a field in England where he really was doing something different, and it got the attention of figures like, you know, Nick Rogue, Scorsese, who exec produced Free Fire. So you know, it's very much editing is central to what he's doing.
And what do you take from his films that you want to instill in the students of yours?
I rather than show the mainly British students a David Lean epic, or even something, even Ken Loach or Mike Lee, Stephen Frears, I feel that showing them Ben Wheatley, many of them will think, I can do that. I'm going to go out and do that. And that's partly his philosophy. Online, you can see the link to the masterclass for the making of A Field in England. Now, few filmmakers in any country go to those lengths. He's a kind of secret teacher, I think, in terms of putting it across to people. Well, this is what you do. This is what's required. So demystifies the process, and that's helpful to me, talking to students, because I can show, you know, I can break it down into components. Yeah.
And perhaps less so with his most recent offering.
Yeah, I didn't get on with High Rise. I have blamed my wife that I saw it with at the Curzon Canterbury, wonderful cinema. But we made it to the end. There were a couple of walkouts.
Yeah,
I think I blame the sort of double curse of Jeremy Thomas and J.G. Ballard. Actually, I think it's more a Jeremy Thomas film than a Ben Wheatley film. For me, I could bore you about that now, but yeah, I think if I can briefly say, all Wheatley's films before Free Fire are concerned with the class system to some extent, the British class system. And one of the liberating things about Free Fire, which is set in Boston in the 1970s, is it's not about the class system. High Rise explicitly is. It's a big metaphor for class, and I think somewhere in there, for me, it got lost with High Rise.
Yeah, I think part of High Rise is getting lost, and you kind of have to succumb to it. And it is, I think, it's effectively a non-narrative music video that lasts for 2 hours. But I think a lot of people were maybe not expecting that.
Yes, after A Field in England, and there's that overused word buzz about Ben Wheatley and his collaborators, and here comes High Rise. And it's produced by Jeremy Thomas, and it looks, and Tom Hiddleston, and all kinds of other wonderful actors. And my expectations were huge, so I went in with the wrong expectations. Mm. I think it's beautifully made, and some fantastic stuff in there. But I also think J.G. Ballard is almost adaptation proof, and it's the Spielberg film, I've forgotten the name of the 1980s adaptation of J.G. Ballard's autobiography.
Oh, Empire of the Sun.
Sorry, Empire of the Sun. I do teach film, everyone. just testing you. Actually, Empire of the Sun has a story, and it's Ballard's story, has a narrative, and that's one of the reasons it's the best screen adaptation of his work. And I think, sounding really old-fashioned here, I think High Rise is not about the story, it's about the vision, and for me it wasn't, it didn't add up, but I need to see it again.
Yeah, I think Sam of this parish said that it's very much, the more you watch it, the better it gets, the more you can lose yourself into it, and I think if you get the chance, maybe on a bigger screen would probably help with that film. And in a strange sense, it almost feels like High Rise, in a weird Ben Wheatley way, was a one for them job as well.
Yes, very good point. I think he's a goes back to artists like, you know, Rubens. You've got to think about who your patrons are, and, you know, one for them, one for me. Famously, you know, Hollywood filmmakers, and recently Clint Eastwood has worked that way. And yeah, it's a very good point. And I wanted it to work and be wonderful, and I obviously need to see it again, and probably on my own, right? And then I'll love it.
Okay. Yeah, and that leads us to Free Fire, which feels like very much one for him. It is even shot in his back garden, basically. This is really a 90-minute shootout set in a Boston warehouse. And it's definitely his most genre-friendly film with the strong 70s American influence. And so, Lawrence, returning to our regularly scheduled podcast pitch, I was wondering if you could pitch me a new American-influenced genre film, but in the hands of any living or dead British low-budget director. Another Wheatley free fire, if you will.
Well, Jake, I had two equally terrible ideas. I'm apologising in advance. So one is Shane Meadows directs a space opera. It's called This Is Pluto. Now, with the current debate about Pluto's status as not being a planet anymore, it's a dwarf planet. So this is the world we're in. It's a science fiction film, but with all the regular Shane Meadows faces. So Thomas Turgoose plays the lead, and it's a coming-of-age story. He's in his 20s now, he's fighting for recognition of what Pluto's status is in the solar system, maybe the galaxy, and he's torn between two mentor figures, and one is a grizzled scouse space pirate, which is quite hard to say, played by Stephen Graham. And on the other side, a kind of action heroine with an eye patch, I see her, played by Vicky McClure, who since The Replacement we know she's very good playing a villainess. And really, it's going to be which side will he choose, and eventually Pluto will get recognition. So that's the bad one. That's the worst of the two.
Okay. I would say that's the great one.
Thank you. Thank you so much. The other one, which now maybe looks, is Joanna Hogg has made, you know, films called Unrelated, Archipelago, Exhibition, and generalising, they're about posh people in crisis, often in Tuscany or the Channel Islands. The Scilly Isles, excuse me. And this one, her film would be called Diaspora, and it's set in 1881 Tombstone, and it's a Western because that's the ultimate American genre. But it would be about transplanted immigrants in the Wild West, played by Tom Hiddleston, who's a regular collaborator. Yep. But it has to be about an affair with probably an older woman. So I think Helena Bonham Carter may be playing a genteel East European immigrant, maybe called Svetlana. And they have an affair. And it's not about the shootout of the OK Corral. It's about the diaspora around the shootout. It's about the other people. And that's a Joanna Hogg Western, everyone.
That's believable. That has the potential to actually exist. I could read that as a headline.
I need to get a life.
Yeah. I mean, it's better. I went down the Western route as well, so I recently rewatched Attack the Block, Joe Cornish's kind of sci-fi council estate invasion film from a few years ago with John Boyega, and I thought that could definitely be a Western. That's already really a Western with this kind of band of outlaws who are helping the kind of small civilization, in this case just a tower block in South London, but I think with Westerns that have kind of disappeared, and they're re-entering our sphere in the form of Django Unchained or the remake of The Magnificent Seven, but the tone for me is just off. Tarantino is I'm a bit iffy with anyway, and it's too parody-y, and The Magnificent Seven remake was a bit too po-faced and a bit too, I didn't quite know what it needed to be. And I think Joe Cornish, like particularly looking at Ant-Man and Tintin as well, he just like he knows the adventure spirit that is needed in a Western as
Great
well.
Great idea.
Yeah, I think there's some legs there. But Joe Cornish is doing nothing. He's apparently got something on the cards, but that's been I think 6 or 7 years now. And so I would like to see at least something to do with Joe Cornish. I make it sound like he's an up-and-comer. He's 48.
Come on, Joe, do some work.
Yeah. Come on. Lazy.
Come on.
Lazy is what it is. But I think in this instance, we've got to give the podcast pitch to the Joanna Hogg Diaspora Western, which I'm sure will be popping up on comingsoon.net very, very shortly.
Yeah.
Cheers for indulging us there, Lawrence.
My pleasure.
And so we will now cut across to Sam Howlett, who is chatting to Ben Wheatley about Free Fire.
Okay, and we're now joined by the director of Free Fire, Ben Wheatley. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Hello. So I guess I'll just start from the beginning with my first question. Where did the idea for Free Fire come from, and how did it come to be your sort of follow-up to High Rise?
It come from I'd been reading transcripts from gunfights that the FBI had been involved in, and I thought it was really fascinating, and they're not at all like you would imagine from watching Hollywood movies, which is no great surprise, I suppose, yeah, to anyone, but it was kind of they're really messy and difficult and protracted, I thought there's something in this, and then I was thinking about that for a few years and just batting it about, and then I kind of I met up with Cillian Murphy, and he was had a few drinks, and he was saying he wanted to, you know, if he ever had an idea or a part that he would be good for, and I kind of thought, well, you know, I can't let this go, you know, I need to, you know, I went home and thought of a thing for him straight away, you know, and that was Free Fire. So I kind of got him, and I got Michael Smiley, and I started thinking about this gun battle thing and the world of a kind of procedural kind of action movie that was changing the scale of action back down from where we've got at the moment, which is kind of massive, down to very small actions, and what was the smallest you could get to, you know, away from when you don't have car chases, what kind of chases do you have?
Sure,
And kind of worked it out from there, really.
Okay, cool. So you mentioned there this kind of desire to like bring the shootout back to what it ultimately is, in a sort of realist way.
To a degree, obviously.
Yeah, obviously.
It's still a movie.
Yeah, and did you kind of shy away from things like sort of slow motion and?
No, we had all that
unrealistic elements.
Well, slow motion is a case in point. Is actually quite realistic?
Yeah.
Apparently,
okay.
That under incredible stress, you, as you probably know from if you've been in an accident, yeah, or something really terrible has happened to you, you can feel that time is going slower, and that is from, it's a physiological thing that your brain does because it processes quicker as part of a survival kind of,
okay,
thing. So people who have been in shootouts have described the experience of going into slow motion.
Yeah.
Or thinking they're just not moving fast enough, and when they, you know, they do it with training and stuff, and they play back the footage, and they're moving really quick, but they feel like they're moving really slow. And some people have tunnel vision, or their vision will go into black and white because the brain will,
okay,
take up anything that it doesn't need, it gets rid of in a survival situation.
Wow. Okay.
Which when I was reading that, I was going, well, that's really, yeah, crazy. So in some ways, like, you know, some of the things, the techniques you see in cinema are kind of quite true.
Okay.
And then other things aren't. So like the kind of idea of blood gouting out of people like it does in movies, or the people being flung backwards by pistol shots and stuff,
right,
is all kind of nonsense, you know, and that had come from the, you know, the simple physics of a gun firing. It can only give as much it can only punch as much as the recoil of the pistol.
Okay.
So, not much in, yeah, that respect. So it doesn't really throw you backwards, unless they were finding. I was reading about this that people were being shot and throwing themselves backwards, and it had been from television.
Okay.
So if they knew they'd been shot, they kind of
automatically
throw themselves to the ground. Whereas if they'd been shot and they didn't see where the bullet had come from, sometimes they wouldn't even notice it for a bit.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Interesting. So as the film is essentially, you know, in its most basic way, it's kind of 90-minute shootout. Mm. I was wondering, what are the kind of other sort of cinematic shootouts that either inspired you or that you were particularly fond of throughout cinema history?
I mean, I looked at kind of, you know, I've always loved the Peckinpah stuff, and I like, you know, The Wild Bunch and the end of Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia and things like that. And then an extension of that is the John Woo movies and the Hard Boiled, or The Killer, Better Tomorrow, also like samurai movies as well, like all the Kurosawa films, like, sure, Seven Samurai and stuff. So all that kind of goes in there into the pot. But really, this was, I guess, one of the weird influences on this is more like Evil Dead 2 or Warner Brothers cartoon,
yeah,
stuff like Tom and Jerry.
Okay.
So that. And that is about kind of visual storytelling and lots of little goals, visual goals that make, you know, it's weird with this movie when it's sold as a kind of, oh, it's just, it's a gunfight that goes on for 90 minutes, but the reality of that is that you have to make it's a lot of story,
yeah,
but the story isn't necessarily plot. Okay. So it makes, you know, and that goes back to silent cinema, you know, and a lot of, you could describe a Chaplin film as just a film about a tramp who gets kicked up the arse a lot, yeah. And that's, you know, it's like,
yeah.
That would be one way of reducing it down to nothing.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned, like, Warner Brothers cartoons, because I was going to mention the kind of almost slapstick at times quality to the film.
Yeah, it was intentional.
Yeah.
Not much happens by accident on the film set, to be fair.
Okay, so there's a lot of, I imagine there's loads of, like, for this film especially, this sort of meticulous planning of each shot has to land in this place and this actor has to fall here. And,
yeah.
Could you talk about the kind of planning that went into this film?
Yeah, it was very heavily storyboarded and worked out, and you just have to, primarily for safety, you know, is one reason, because you just can't have all that stuff going on and not knowing what's going to happen next. Someone will get hurt, because it's, you know, it's reasonably challenging and dangerous. And it had to be, you know, some of the, every bullet hit in the wall, most of the, you know, almost 90% of the effects were practical, so every time a bullet hits the wall, it's, you know, something that has to be planned up to 6 or 7 weeks beforehand. So, you know, really, there was a lot of planning went into it.
Okay. And, so you mentioned quite a few films earlier. So there's something kind of interesting in your films that you don't tend to, that I've noticed anyway, explicitly reference or in a kind of postmodern, ironic way. Is that something you almost try to avoid and be a sort of...
I don't really... I think that my experience of making movies is as I'm a witness to the story, and so I see it and I feel you know, part of my job is to create the atmosphere on set and to create an atmosphere to work in, and then when the actors are doing their job and the camera is doing its job and they're creating an atmosphere, and then I have to kind of capture it to film, so to then pour into that mix other people's movies becomes really complicated.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I think there's a place for that kind of filmmaking, but it was never something I was that interested in. So, and to make kind of films that are kind of explicit references to other movies is a different type of filmmaking than what I'm involved in.
Okay. This is a big cast, and not just in terms of number, but in terms of like names. Like, these are big, worldwide, internationally recognised names. I mean, you've worked with big names before, but this seems the most almost sort of Hollywood-friendly cast. Would you maybe say that this is perhaps your most accessible film for like a mass audience in that respect?
I'd say that the casting is at a similar level to High Rise.
Okay.
Sure. I mean, Hiddleston's massive.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
so
he's kind of, you know, but and Luke Evans is massive as well, obviously. So I don't think it's any different in that respect. I think it's certainly a friendlier film to the audience than maybe High Rise was, you know.
Okay.
And it meets them a bit more halfway.
Yeah.
But it's still quite a weird film.
Certainly, yeah.
Fundamentally. But it feels a little bit more... I mean, it's kind of... I think it's fun in a way that some of the other films were a bit more... I've made were a bit more punishing, you know.
Yeah.
Which I like punishing cinema, you know.
Certainly.
But it's been interesting doing this tour and going to all these places and seeing the audience react to it, you know, and coming away really liking it.
Yeah. Is that something you think about often, like when you do when you film something or write something, oh God, what are they going to think of this, or how are they going to react to that? Or
yeah, that's the whole job.
Yeah.
You know, you think, and as the creator of it, you kind of... are trading at every point on your own taste and going, I guess I'm the audience. And if I like it, because I like certain films, I don't like other films, and I have my own particular tastes, and I have unreasonable tastes sometimes, you know, that don't, it's not the film's fault I don't like it, it's some other thing outside of thing that's made that happen. So, and I think, well, you know, and I try and make films I want to watch, and then you find out, you know, because sometimes they're your niche tastes are niche.
Yeah.
Sometimes your kind of broader tastes are accessible, so that's good.
Yeah, excellent. Okay. And I wanted to quickly talk about as well Charlotte Copley's character, because he's perhaps the most eccentric and loud and broad. I was wondering where that character came from.
It comes from the script and from working with Sholto. Okay. So he's Sholto's a great improviser, so he gave us loads of material. But also, Amy Jump, the screenwriter, was rewriting as we shot.
Oh, okay.
So there was a lot of stuff put back into it, playing off of what Sholto was doing. And then Amy did this really great thing with the ADR, the additional dialogue recording stuff, where she wrote like almost another script, which was all the background dialogue that kind of glued the whole movie together. And so that character was brought up a lot in all that dialogue, you know, and sharpened into that. So, but yeah, I mean, I thought I like big characters like that, and I think he's really, really funny, you know, fundamentally funny, and is the heart of the film for most of it. But then, you know, there was some great improvisation from Armie Hammer as well, and obviously Smiley's always great.
Yeah. Okay. And I guess my last question for you then would be that sort of in a world of sort of prequels, sequels, and remakes, like how difficult is it now to get an original film made and put out there?
I think that I've not had too much trouble making stuff. I mean, it's never easy, but it's not. I don't feel like that. I think there's an appetite for good cinema always, you know, and for stuff that when the script for Free Fire went round, you know, people wanted to make the film. You know, they wanted to finance it, and it happened quite quickly straight after. I mean, it was almost back to back with High Rise. So from my perspective, it's not too bad. I think it's a tougher one in a world of where everything is asking for your attention, that is, you know, that from the incredible kind of tsunami of TV that's being pumped out, and video games and everything else that we've got, and music and whatnot. So that to make something that's brand new that you then have to educate everybody about, that's a slight barrier to people going is a bit of a risk. But then I think that also culture can become a bit bland as well, and people just get sick of it after a while and want something new. So, and I think that it always goes in cycles like this. It always has done. You know, the cowboy movie went on for decades, you know, and I think the superheroes thing will be the same.
Yeah.
Superheroes are all genre at the same time, except for they wear their pants over the top of their trousers, so it's slightly different, but it's kind of, you know, the song remains the same.
Sure. Ben Whitley, thank you so much for joining us.
Cheers, man. Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so there we are. Sam Howlett talking to Ben Whitley about the new film Free Fire. And don't forget to hold on, as later on we will be talking to Christian Mungiu. That will be coming after the spoiler section about Free Fire. So do make sure you stay tuned in for that. So, Lawrence, Free Fire. We watched this the other day, and I think after it finished, I normally have to wait a few minutes before I feel comfortable how people feel about something. But you were straight into that one.
I was. It's that kind of film. I think it's a magnificent achievement, and it's almost like the prestige accruing to High Rise and the budget, the moving budget from A Field in England skywards. It's like he's wearing the prestige lightly. He doesn't care so much, and it's all about the film. These wonderful performances, great ensemble piece. Not a weak link in the cast. It's tight as a drum, and I did say the M word, and I thought about it, and I mean it. I think it's a masterpiece of its kind. I relate that to a film like Peckinpah's Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia from 1974, which is a strange quasi-Western Mexican Gothic film, but in a way it's perfect, and I think Free Fire is perfect.
So it's in terms of what it's trying to achieve, it does so?
Completely. Even if you just leave thinking, yep, it does what it says on the tin, I think Wheatley and his cohorts will be happy with that. But there's a lot of other influences and construction and ideas underneath, if you want to look for that. But absolutely, it was. It does sound degenerate to say you leave with a smile on your face, because it's a shoot 'em up. I don't want to say how many people die. There's a lot of shooting. But it's not nihilistic.
No. I mean, it's safe to say not everyone comes out alive.
Yeah, let's say that.
And so this all begins with very few moments outside of the warehouse, which I imagine must have been a bit of a joy to film after spending 12 weeks inside the warehouse.
Yes, I think it's the Lucky Dip and Michael Smiley and a few others got to be in Boston, right? Unlike everyone else who's, well, in Brighton. Could be worse.
In an old newspaper building.
There you go.
So we've got Cillian Murphy, Michael Smiley, Brie Larson making some kind of deal. There's a bit. Michael Smiley's more of a security there, and then we get introduced to Armie Hammer's Ord, who is a very slick American who's effectively the negotiator for this arms deal.
If I could talk about the casting, it's the construction of the screenplay by Amy Jump and Ben Wheatley. So it works symmetrically. So you have two working class outlaws. I've just contradicted myself because it's not about class, but they're ordinary Joes, played by it's Sam Riley and Enzo Cilenti, and I can't remember the other two. It's
Jack Rayner.
Noah Taylor and Jack Rayner. They're all fantastic. And so you've got those two pairs, and then you have Armie Hammer and Sholto Copley's characters,
yeah.
And you also have Cillian Murphy and Michael Smiley's characters, and it is a dance. I think it was you said it first, Jake, that it's a dance between all these different characters, exquisitely choreographed,
yeah.
And it wears it very lightly, and it's funny.
Yeah. And I think immediately when you tell someone that, oh, it's a gunfight set all inside a warehouse, people jump to Reservoir Dogs straight away. And the first big dialogue-driven scene between this kind of heightened character of Sholto Copley's Vern when they're negotiating the actual transaction of the money for the guns, that moment is only its real Tarantino comparable moment, I think.
From what I hear, Wheatley's not into explicit referentiality, like kind of winking over your shoulder at the audience, whereas our friend Tarantino is known for that, and the word postmodern is overused. But I find that with so many of Tarantino's films, like Kill Bill, are about the experience of watching a film, but you know, you've got Sergio Leone, you've got all kinds of other influences coming in, Japanese cinema, and it's there with Wheatley's films, but especially Free Fire, but you don't have to go looking for it. It's implicit, not explicit, the referentiality. And that's, so you could glibly say that Tarantino's films are about himself, reflecting himself, and I think Wheatley's films are about the film.
Yeah.
Free Fire's about the film.
There are moments where you can think of it, oh, that as a Ben Wheatley film, but as you say, the film comes first before he does.
Absolutely.
And so this deal is done, but it turns out two of the chaps in the room have actually met each other before in a bar fight the night before, and that is what springs a good 80 minutes of gunfire from that moment. And from there on out, I think I was very surprised at how bored I didn't get.
I completely agree. I think it escalates marvellously, and it's carefully, as with all the Amy Jump screenplays, sometimes co-written with Ben Wheatley or Robin Hill, it's expertly mapped. So the story keeps on escalating, and even in terms of locations. So am I allowed to mention the telephone?
Yeah.
You know, the introduction of, am I allowed, the concept of, what am I allowed?
Normally being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
To do. When the phone rings, that raises the stakes again and opens up the cinematic space. And so they got to get to the phone, which is somewhere in this warehouse, and that's a new location. It's it's carefully pre-planned, and it all, you know, falls into place.
And talking about planning, I've got to ask you, from your perspective as someone who has made films and teaches filmmaking, the thing that most astounded me is the production on this must have been the biggest unimaginable nightmare.
I would rather be the production designer on Barry Lyndon, right, in 1975, or I don't know what, right, with, obviously they had a bigger budget, even a bigger budget than Free Fire, but what a job to pull off. Incredible. And again, going back to wearing its research lightly, the retro styling of the whole film doesn't push itself into your face. You know, it's a beautifully designed warehouse, amazingly lit by Laurie Rose, all kinds of stuff going on, but you're gripped by the story in the foreground. But what a job to convert this warehouse. And it's almost as if what he was doing with High Rise, he thought, okay, I'm going to apply that to Free Fire. I'm going to scale it back. And it is a controlled space. Mm. Even if it was a nightmare for the production manager and art direction team, but it's a more controlled space than what they were doing with High Rise, I believe. Yeah.
I mean, with this, I know Laurie Rose had a really... intricate but amazing lighting system that was all hanging from the ceiling and controlled from an iPad. So if anyone moved into any part of the room, rather than having to move tripods around, he could just put sliders up on this iPad and light that part of the room and move it around. So people had the freedom to go wherever they wanted. And I think there was a multi-camera setup as well. But I think that would have been still too there must have been some restraints, like you can't go there, you can't move there, I think, because it always almost feels like a lot of the script stipulates where people have to be as well, because there's so much hiding, and the way that people deliver their lines, they are to people that are far away from them as well. It must have just been such a nightmare looking at storyboards and plans for this warehouse where people have to be at each time.
Well, I read in a piece last week that Wheatley planned it all in advance using Minecraft, and that's bringing together, you could argue, the two sides of his ability, which is strategic and practical, and on the other side his interest in actors and his gift with actors, which shouldn't be underestimated. It's just phenomenal what he's got with the cast here, because we know they're good, people like Brie Larson, Michael Smiley, Cillian Murphy. And yet they're so relaxed, all of them, and that's interesting what you say about Laurie Rose. So they had the freedom to move around. He would have, I'm sure, to a certain extent, designed shots around what they were doing, you know, blocking the action, then working out the camera positions. But he's said to be very relaxed, but also work very quickly, which I still can't work out how he does that, but if you can do it, then that's nirvana.
I think when you look at his films and you think how quickly, for instance, A Field in England was actually made, I think he's just really into the kind of problem solving of filmmaking and preempting that beforehand.
Yeah, good point. I think his instinct for actors and performers must come, I'm speculating, from working in TV drama, well, TV comedy, so Modern Toss, but then The Wrong Door, and Ideal, the Johnny Vegas TV comedy, where you don't have any time. You may do two takes, maybe more, but what you have got is comic performers who will give you something, often improvised, go off script. And I'm sure he took a lot from that, and obviously Michael Smiley he's worked with consistently. So people will give you something in two, three takes if you cast them right. Often they're comic performers like Dan Skinner in High Rise, for example, and he's got a real eye for that, I think.
And do you think there will be, with this film, bringing in global superstars such as Brie Larson and Armie Hammer? I think with High Rise, Tom Hiddleston is the biggest name there, but he's still very much of an English sensibility and may have not been as hard to catch compared to Academy Award winner Brie Larson. Do you think that will change the dynamic that people have with Wheatley now? Like, because this is clearly going to be its most American accessible film.
Well, I'm very interested to see what the reception of this film is going to be, because it could be just me and you and a few others extolling its greatness and this sort of deafening silence about its stature.
Mm.
I think because I am writing a lot about British cinema and Andrea Arnold, Ben Wheatley, and both of them recently have moved across the Atlantic in terms of where they're setting their films. So American Honey or Free Fire. So what are they going to do next? Now, I've heard, I'm sure you have, that the next Wheatley project might be Freak Shift,
mm.
which he's had for a while. And I don't know if that is an American American film, but he surely can do that now. It depends on what the reception is of this. I still, certainly in academia and among critics, detect a snobbery towards his films because they're for an audience, and I hope that Free Fire gets the plaudits it deserves because of its craftsmanship, mm. Rather than being, it is pulp cinema, but it's also, I mean, it's worthy of mentioning in the same breath as I think Don Siegel and Robert Aldrich films from the 50s. So it's you know, full of energy.
And you mentioned these English directors making more American films. The other person that's mentioned in your PhD is Paddy Considine, whose next feature is that American thing, the boxing film as well.
Exactly, yeah. And I'll be interested to see what Danny Lee says about Free Fire, because he writes so well about, he made a documentary about boxing films, the genre of the boxing film, and he probably will have a lot to say about, is it Journeyman? Is
yeah.
that the Paddy Considine film? Yeah, I think, I mean, I actually think, I'm going off topic, but Tyrannosaur, I think, is quite an American piece of filmmaking. I think it's a muscular, lean bit of screen storytelling, attributes you traditionally associate with American cinema. It's not quote unquote art house filmmaking. I think it's a hybrid film of two different sensibilities. Wonderful film. So I'm looking forward to to Journeyman for sure.
Mm. I'm excited for to see what that's like, just because Tyrannosaur, I read, was, or Constantine said, was edited on iMovie, which and there's a lot of pretentiousness.
It's very well
about,
edited.
Yeah, and people get up in arms about the things that people are making things on, and I think if someone can make something like that and do it on some nice
good luck
free
to
software,
you.
Yeah. And so, actually, go on your PhD there, Lawrence. We might. What's could you give us a bit more information about like what it is you're writing about?
Yeah, it's early days. I teach full time. This is my big disclaimer. I teach full time filmmaking here at University of Kent. So part time, I'm writing about, I'm calling it The Pestilence in the Ditch, Unquiet Landscape in Contemporary British Cinema, and I'm looking at chiefly the work of Andrea Arnold, Paddy Considine, and Ben Wheatley.
Well, it's what a coincidence that we were just talking about them.
That's amazing. And also, I want to bring in to the thesis, I'll bring in a film called Catch Me Daddy by Daniel Wolfe, which is an extraordinary film. But really, its landscape is inimical to the films. Place is very important to the filmmakers. And so here we go with Free Fire. It's Boston. It's a warehouse in the 1970s. So there's a freedom to it. I think that's one of its the feelings it gives you as a viewer, because he's out of his comfort zone, Ben Wheatley, and he's left Kent, Essex, the motorways of Kill List behind, and it's exciting.
Yeah, and I think, although you mentioned the ditch there, I think there's a certain dirtiness and griminess that I think of when I think of Ben Wheatley's films.
Yeah.
And that is true of this as well. There's a horrible shot with Michael Smiley's hand and a needle.
Absolutely,
which is gruesome. And that was a little hint of, oh, I remember who directed this.
An Acura 1978 hypodermic, I'm sure. Mm. Yeah. Well, he traffics in the grotesque, I think, Ben Wheatley. So Kill List is a very dark film, maybe his darkest, but all of the films are about death in one way or another. A Field in England is certainly about that. And arguably the alehouse they're looking for at the bottom of the field is death. And so with Free Fire, I mean, this is me tidily connecting it to my theories about Wheatley, which is it's about democracy, and death is the great leveler. So everyone's equal.
Mm.
You know, a bullet doesn't make any distinction whether you're well born or not. And so I think there's that stuff going on in the background of Free Fire. But really, you know, here it is. If I can say also, I think it is a dream of those films that were on in the 70s and 80s when someone like me was growing up, which is films starring Oliver Reed, Richard Harris, Richard Burton, films like Where Eagles Dare, Hannibal Brooks, which are a kind of boy's own dream of a shoot 'em up, and most of them desperately politically incorrect. And somewhere, I think Ben Wheatley must have absorbed those films, as well as, and many of them not good films, some of them were, and he's placed it here for us in Free Fire, so it's there if you want it, but you don't have to get those references. But I think it's in the DNA of the film.
Excellent. So there we are. That is Ben Wheatley's Free Fire. Do stick around for a few more minutes if you want some of the spoiler section. If you have seen the film already, if you haven't, what are you doing? Go out, check it out. Pause us now and then come back. And if you want to listen to the Christian Mungiu interview, then skip forward by about 5 minutes and we'll have that for you as well. So that's your spoiler warning starting now. And so, Lawrence, what did you make of the kind of third act revelations?
I at the end, working back from the end, which I like to do, and we can spoil it, right?
We certainly can.
Okay, I'm really going to spoil it. I think that it's the woman, Justine, who nearly gets away with the cash. I thought, there you go. It's a film noir. It's, you know, the killers. It's a neo-noir. All these things, and I didn't see it coming. So maybe that's just me. Did you?
First time, because I've seen it twice now. First time around, I didn't. And then second time around, because I knew there's a lot of setup. There's a lot of neat little nods to it.
She says at the start, I'm in it for the money,
doesn't
she? So it's, you know, Dames is no good.
Yep.
You know, it's the same as a film like Brick or The Maltese Falcon or whatever. I think everything was... The foundations were laid so clearly at the start. For example, what's going to happen between Sam Riley's character and Jack Rayner's? They had to sort of die in an embrace of death.
Oh, the lovers.
And all of that, it delivers all of that, yet in a way that bizarrely seems original. I mean, all these things that it's a genre film, it's a pulp film, and yet if you work within the parameters of your chosen genre, you can subvert and surprise. I think it does. I think the death of Armie Hammer took me by surprise, and I thought, oh, that was Wheatley and Robin Hill and those guys' experience making cunning stunts, which are available online, in the surprise moment of violence, and that kind of it was brilliantly done.
Yeah, and it comes just on. And a very true of his character line, just going, now I've got a great John Denver story.
And also he reminded me, Armie Hammer reminds me of an MA student here. Sam, not your Sam, another Sam. So I must discuss that with him. Yeah, it's the luxuriant beard.
Yeah. And just how calm and cool he is. I think Armie Hammer said that he made a backstory for him where he had been to Vietnam and he had been so much more worse than this, that in this situation he could just sit back and smoke a spliff and be absolutely fine with it.
I think once all the plates are spinning, or to mix my metaphors terribly, the wheels are set in motion, it's inexorable. So, you know, fate is coming towards these characters in the warehouse. But I didn't feel resentful of the futility of it. There was a beauty in the closure, I thought. So, for example, another dance of death between Michael Smiley's character and Sholto Copley, who is hilarious. His characters, even in this group, you know, it's preposterous. Sholto Copley's character, yeah.
Yeah, he is probably the best thing in it. I do think he's almost like what I imagine a mafia David Brent in the 70s would be like.
I completely agree. I think, I've got to say, for me, he's not the best thing in it because it's truly an ensemble film. And I think those other players like Cillian Murphy, for example, Michael Smiley, some of them are underplaying so that Sam Riley, who, there's no way you can play that part and underplay it. The part that Sam Riley's got, this kind of Popeye junky loose cannon. Right? He makes Johnny Boy in Mean Streets look stable. And Sholto Copley's character has to be ridiculous. And so, but the others around him are shoring him up. So it's, and I'm sure that, you know, Wheatley's eye as a director on the levels of his performance was there. And he edits so well around everyone's performances. So it's generous, you know, everyone gets their day in court, which I think is a line from Smiley in the film.
I think maybe my favourite reveal of the whole thing is when the sprinkler system turns on and you see that the factory was an umbrella factory.
Exactly, which I didn't get because I've only seen it once, as to your twice.
Yeah.
It's full of, it's the details. So, for example, I think it's Martin is the character who, that whole sequence, you could connect it to A Field in England's kind of hallucinatory climax, where he's stumbling around with the bag full of money, and he should be dead, but why isn't he? And that, so again, the grotesque and that edge of sort of comedy and extreme violence, and I think because of the way the film is positioned, I think hopefully a lot of audiences will like it. They shouldn't.
I think
because it's disturbing, but I think because of the way it's positioned, it's it works.
Yeah, I think it's definitely his most accessible.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there we are. That is Ben Wheatley's Free Fire, which is out in cinemas now, as is Christian Munsu's Graduation. And so if you'd like to stay tuned in, here is an interview with Munsu taken at the London Film Festival last year as part of our In the Projection Booth series. We've just got a section of the interview here, but if you would like to watch the whole thing, then you can do so by checking out the film on Curzon Home Cinema. Christian, what was the origin of the film for you?
Well, I think first of all it starts with the fact that I'm a father and I spend a lot of time thinking about my children, thinking about what's best to tell your children. But aside from this, it's a bit of everything. I really wanted to make a film about corruption, but more about compromise, and not only about corruption in Romania. I don't see this film as being so local as sometimes people imagine. And I've been having quite good responses from audiences all over the place, just understanding that if you speak about compromise, for example, this is not localized somewhere. It's a way of behaving, a way of being in life. And I hope that, you know, at the end of the day, the film speaks about human nature a lot. It speaks about parenting. It speaks about this necessity of getting out the truth of your life. So I think it's very layered. And I hope it speaks to people from, I don't know, a lot of places, because that's the point with what I do. I hope that you can watch the story of these people on screen, but think about your own life eventually.
And what is the way out of this situation? Is education the solution?
Well, I'm not sure that I know the way out. You know, you just make a film, you tell a story about something that you think it's important, but this was going on for so long that it became a habit for people to behave like this. And it's not so clear to see what's the way out. But the only way out is to step outside of this circle and to imagine that if you won't be giving the same kind of education to your children as the one that you got, maybe there are some chances, but you have to start by acknowledging things about yourself. Maybe you're not such a nice person as you wanted people to believe you are, especially when you reach this age. The film speaks about also about this, about education, and about this idea that we're always optimistic about the future. based on the younger generation saying that they will save us, they will be different. But how will they be different if they are the result of our education? I'm not so sure. So I think this really needs a very conscious effort of stopping this and of, you know, switching this to a different kind of education, and eventually before everybody leaves.
Is there a general struggle or difference?
I'm not sure that this is too much related to communism, honestly. I think that there's always this difference in views about a lot of things, and especially about ethical things in society, about from, you know, the older generation to the young generation. But the only thing which is connected probably to communism is this habit of using compromise as a surviving tool, in a way. Because, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, in all those countries, it wasn't about having like a lot of ethical principles or whatever. It was about surviving. So you would do whatever it takes, and people got this habit that because the society is not really well organized and it's still troubled, it's important to find whatever solution to just solve the problems, which was the case then. It might still be the case now, but it shouldn't be as much the case. Things have evolved. You could find different solutions. If you're displeased with the society that you see around you, you should start by doing something yourself. This is somehow the point of what the character tries to do in the film. But I hope he's not cynical. I think he's tired. And I think he got to this moment in his life when he's disappointed. And I think people are disappointed because, you start with high hopes when you're young, and eventually you can reach this moment in your life when things are so different than what you imagined, and you still have to live on. So that's a difficult moment, and the film is the portrait of that moment.
If Romeo had left Romania, do you think he'd feel differently?
Nobody can have an answer to this. You know, for example, I keep on talking to people of my generation. Most of them have left in the 90s. You know, people who left and emigrated someplace else, they still believe that if they stayed, maybe their life would be more meaningful, while people who stayed imagine that if they had left in the 90s, maybe they would be happier. You know, you never know. It's in the human nature to imagine that the path that you didn't take was taking you somewhere nicer. So it's difficult to say. What's important is that, you know, we made this conscious choice in the 90s of staying. While today it's a bit more complicated because it's like 25 years later, and you have to make this choice for the children. Actually, Eliza, he doesn't want Eliza to emigrate. He wants his children to be happy. We all want this. We all want us to be happy and our children to be happy. But it's just people. It's just that people imagine at some point that if it's very difficult to foresee this where you live, you will just imagine that it's easier someplace else. Not necessarily because it is easier, but because you don't have all the details about this remote place. So, you know, they place all the hopes in the world on these places that they don't know very well.
Yeah, like when he talks about her being chased by squirrels in Kensington Gardens, which is this sort of fantasy.
It's a very romantic view about the Western society, but it's the result of, you know, fantasizing about this for a very long period during the communist times when people were having very little information about what was happening somewhere else. And they were not only imagining that, I don't know, the world here is wealthier, but they were imagining it's, there's a lot of correctness here, and people are, you know, it's everything is based on merit, and probably it is based on merit in a greater degree than at home, but it's not like, you know, this is happening.
To what extent is this a personal story?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's more a personal story, this one, than the ones that I did before, which were about girls as main characters. It's always something personal, but it's not autobiographical. It's not based on my life, but it's based on things that I think a lot about, as my previous films. Even 4 months was personal for me, or even Beyond the Hills. Even it's difficult to set the connection, but it's about things that, I don't know, are in your mind in that period in your life. And from this perspective, this one is also personal, maybe the most personal film that I did, because I spend a lot of time not thinking about, I don't know, cinema and the future of the world. I think about my children, and then a lot of this thinking is in the film as well.
Looking back, do you think that your previous films were thematically similar to other Romanian films of the time?
I think we're still, and even this film and even what happens today, it's still considered part to be of part of this movement or moment or whatever. But this is not a movement based on a statement of any kind. So it's just a way of finding a name for what happened with the Romanian films in the last 10, 15 years, which was quite unexpected. And at the end, yes, I think there are some similarities, but mostly about the style, mostly about the way of doing, mostly about this principles of avoiding like big subjects and going to minimal things and getting inspiration rather from reality than from cinema, and doing stories which happen in a very short while in the film. Yes, maybe this is in part similar. But at the same time, if you go a little bit deeper into this current, you see that there are as many differences between these directors. And I think this is good, that they're not respecting a kind of a formal aesthetical manifest. It's just they feel that they belong to this group of people which started working more or less at the same age, at the same time. It's the new generation of Romanian directors who didn't make films before the revolution. We started all after the year 2000, which was a very bad year for the Romanian cinema, the first time when we couldn't produce any film. And then all of a sudden it was this group of people which emerged. And I think that probably all of us did this kind of cinema as a reaction at the same time to what was happening before, which was very, very different. So I think it's mostly a reaction against something than driven from, the history of the Romanian cinema.
Has your voice as a filmmaker changed over the years?
I think that for the last two or three films, the direction is still pretty clear. It's just that every time the story shapes the film a lot. So people notice some differences, but they come from the story. They don't come from the director's decision to go into a different direction. I think that my view about this, about cinema, is the same for the last, 5, 8 years, 10 years, and for the films that I do. It's only that, there are these small differences about what interests you at a certain point in your life, and this will be reflected from the story and the style that you use.
How did winning the Palme d'Or affect your career?
I think they became easier in the sense that, of course, it was easier to finance the films. But honestly, I didn't have this problem even before. I managed to finance my own films up to 4 months without too many problems. It also came with some pressure, of course, because if you set the level so high from the beginning, people will just have expectations. So it's not that easy. But at the same time, I think this happens to every director. You are judged, considered what you did before. So I shouldn't be complaining. It's great for me that all of a sudden this placed me in this, in the view. I was in the spotlight because of the popularity of this award, because of the Cannes Film Festival, because of the Palme d'Or. So there is a lot of curiosity about what I do, which stays every time for every new film that I make. So I think I was lucky.
There we are, Christian Mungiu on his new film, Graduation, and that is available on Curzon Home Cinema now. And he has also curated a special collection of films available on Curzon Home Cinema. So do make sure you go on there and check those out too. And another recommendation on the Home Cinema service this week comes from Lawrence.
I would like to recommend A Field in England, which is Ben Wheatley's fourth film, came out in 2013. And was released across Film 4, Channel 4, kind of multi-platform pioneering way of releasing it. And it's what I believe he called a midnight movie, which is something that you watch in the middle of the night and aren't sure, did you see that? What's going on? And I loved it. And it is divisive because it's elliptical and doesn't offer easy answers. It's about a small group of soldiers in the English Civil War, my second favourite war, after the 30 Years' War, the same century, but I digress. And they're in a field, And they have to find some treasure under the spell of a necromancer played by Michael Smiley. And really, it is about, it works as an analysis of the British class system, in that Richard Glover gives a beautiful performance as this character called Friend, who is just sort of worm's eye view of the world. Rhys Shearsmith is terrific as a kind of would-be academic astronomer. There's only, I think, four or five characters, beautifully written by Amy Jump, and they have to go to work for the necromancer. And I'm really not selling this very well, but it's shot in black and white, amazing widescreen black and white cinematography by Laurie Rose, and I just think it's been sold as a hallucinogenic trip into the past, which it is, and likened to 2001 in its climactic edit frenzy, when the main characters are hallucinating.
There is what has become iconic in the rope scene.
Yeah, which is Smiley's character, who's called O'Neill, casts a spell on Rhys Shearsmith's character, and you hear this screaming going on inside the magician's tent, and then Rhys Shearsmith exits the tent with a rope around his midriff, with this appalling expression on his face, and I don't know how it was written in the screenplay, but you believe he's seen into the bowels of hell. And it is terrifying. The music, by the way, same sound designer as Free Fire, Martin Pavey. Incredible soundscape that he creates. And Jim Williams' music, which is sort of folk electronica. And anyway, it's an art house film that's also uncategorizable. And it's really in line from a film like Performance, or Bad Timing, those Nick Rogue films from the late 60s, early 70s. And I love it.
Brilliant. There we are. That's Field in England. So do make sure you check that out on Curzon Home Cinema now as well. And that's all we've got time for. So thank you, as usual, to CSR for letting us use their studio. And thank you to Lawrence Jackson for joining us this week.
Thank you very much, Jake.
And until next week, it's goodbye. See you next time. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.